Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly. The Trump trials. Same day, same city, two different courtrooms. The latest on the former president's double legal threats. Assigning blame. ISIS-K claims responsibility for the deadly terror attack on a Moscow concert hall. But the Russian government is pointing the finger at Ukraine. Our expert weighs in. Make way for the Lord. Hundreds of the faithful gather at the Vatican for Palm Sunday. What was missing and why it's a hot topic. We'll explain these stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Well, thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Dismas. Our top story tonight, former President Donald Trump faces mixed news in court. One of his criminal trials will move forward next month. However, he did win more time to fight a massive civil fraud judgment against him. A New York appeals court agreed to hold off collection of Trump's $454 million fine. That's if he can put up $175 million by early April. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, good evening to you. It's a bit of good news for former President Donald Trump as he battles four criminal cases against him while running for president. If Trump can pay it, and today he said he would, it will stop the clock on collection and prevent the state from seizing his assets while he appeals. But his multiple legal battles do not end there.
This morning in New York, former President Donald Trump reacts to the last-minute news that he now has 10 days to come up with $175 million and keep the state of New York from seizing his properties. Potential targets could include his Trump Tower penthouse, aircraft, Wall Street office building, or golf courses.
Greatly respect the decision of the appellate division, and we will abide by that.
The state also could go after his bank and investment accounts. Trump's lawyers pleaded for a state appeals court to halt collection, claiming it was a practical impossibility to get an underwriter to sign off on a bond for such a large sum.
We'll put up cash or bond very quickly, securities, cash or bond, whatever it is. We'll put it up very quickly and we'll win the case.
Trump made those comments at a news conference after attending a crucial hearing involving another case where he's charged with falsifying business records, the so-called hush money case. Today, a New York judge scheduled an April 15th trial date. Trump has pleaded not guilty, calling the case a witch hunt and a hoax.
We have a man who just ruled he'd like the trial to start in 21 days or something. And I don't know how you can have a trial that's going on right in the middle of an election. Not fair. Not fair.
Trump also faces charges of election interference in Georgia. A judge determined District Attorney Fannie Willis could stay on the case, despite a romantic relationship with a former lead prosecutor.
I don't feel like we've been slowed down at all. I do think that there are efforts to slow down this train, but the train is coming.
Meanwhile, President Joe Biden continues campaigning. He's making a joint appearance with Vice President Kamala Harris tomorrow in Raleigh, North Carolina. Then on Holy Thursday, he heads to New York City for a campaign event there. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, now to the investigation into the terror attack on the Moscow concert hall. Officials now say the death toll has risen to 139 people, with a Russian president claiming the massacre was carried out by, quote, radical Islamists. Authorities say that they have identified an additional three more suspects who are accused in the Crocus City Hall attack. Two brothers and their father appeared in court today with no signs of injuries. This is in sharp contrast to the other four suspects who appeared late last night and were visibly beaten. Three of the men pleaded guilty to committing a terrorist attack. They're all from the former Soviet Republic of Tajikistan. At the site of the deadly attack, the Russian Emergency Ministry said 90% of the Moscow concert hall was cleared of rubble. Emergency workers are dismantling and removing metal structures as canine teams examine the area. The Russian president has pointed the finger at Ukraine for the attack, but the U.S. disagrees.
There was no Ukrainian involvement, period. You've seen the Ukrainian government make that clear. And of course, with respect to these statements, the Russians have offered zero evidence because there is no evidence. We did offer warnings to the government of Russia in early March about a planned terrorist attack in Moscow, specifically potentially targeting large gatherings, including concerts.
All right. For more, let's bring in Claire Lopez, founder and president of Lopez Liberty LLC. Claire, good to see you as always. So tell us, what do we know about ISIS-K and why they carried out this terrorist attack against Russians?
Right. So consensus seems to be forming around naming the Islamic State Khorasan as the perpetrator of this horrific terror attack at the Crocus Concert Hall in Moscow or near Moscow. The Islamic State Khorasan is an offshoot of the Middle East original ISIS, Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, which, of course, we know changed its name in June of 2014 to simply Islamic State, precisely because it had expanded its operations beyond just the Middle East. And then at that time, 2014, 2015, got a foothold in Afghanistan. And from there, that group has been expanding its jihadist activities and operations. And it is now the focus of blame for this horrific terror attack at the Moscow Concert Hall.
Yeah, Claire, and a little over 2 weeks ago, Russia's Federal Security Service, known as FSB, said that it thwarted an attack on a synagogue in Moscow by ISIS-K. So it seems they were already likely on high alert about this group. How do you think they were able to slip through and commit this horrific attack?
Well, you know, in addition to that earlier threat that thankfully was thwarted, the United States government in early March, March 7th, provided a warning to the Russian government as well through the American embassy in Moscow to any Americans in Russia that there was a threat of a terror attack and that people should avoid large gathering places like a concert hall. For whatever reason, the Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonin, denied that the Russian government had ever received any warning from the United States. So I'm not quite sure where the disconnect is there, but that warning definitely was passed along. I'm not 100% convinced myself yet that even Islamic State Khorasan was to blame and that it was not some kind of a false flag operation by the Kremlin itself. I can't say for sure, but I have some doubts about that, put it that way. The four that were captured and arraigned over the weekend were four Tajik migrant workers in Russia. But however, during the attack, and it's on video, they seem to be very professionally trained, methodically shooting, murdering people in the concert hall. Migrant Tajik laborers, it doesn't completely line up. I don't know.
Yeah, Claire, I want to quickly ask you this before we run out of time. As mentioned, you know, Russian media and President Putin are really trying to push the narrative that Ukraine is to blame for this attack, despite ISIS, of course, claiming responsibility. Do you think Ukraine could have anything to do with this? And if not, you know, why do you think Putin is doing this? Why do you think he's trying to place the blame on Ukraine?
Absolutely not. Ukraine had absolutely nothing to do with this. There's no question. Ukrainians would not attack in a terrorist attack like this civilians in Moscow or any other place.
All right, we're going to leave right there.
But the reason is that, of course, you know, Putin wants to lay blame with Ukraine right now.
Yeah, and we have to leave it right there, Claire. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Thank you, as always, for coming on. Your
Thank
insights.
You.
Always appreciate it. All right, relations between the U.S. and Israel are becoming even more strained after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called off a high-level delegation's visit to Washington today. The move came after the U.N. Security Council passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during the month of Ramadan. It also called for the release of all hostages taken in the Hamas-led attack on October 7th. According to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry, more than 32,000 Palestinians have died since the war began. It does not distinguish, however, between civilian deaths and combatant casualties. While 14 countries of the UN Security Council backed the measure, the U.S. abstained from the vote, allowing it to pass.
It is our hope will help ease the suffering of the population in Gaza.
Prime Minister Netanyahu denounced the U.S. failure to veto the resolution, saying that it was a, quote, retreat from consistent American position since the beginning of the war. U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the vote is not a reflection of any change in U.S. policy. The meetings between the Biden administration and Israel were set to focus on alternatives to Israel's planned ground operation into Rafah. More than 1 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering in that region. The Biden administration says an offensive would create a humanitarian crisis. Netanyahu says going into Rafah is necessary to dismantle Hamas. The head of the UN agency working in the Palestinian territory said today that Israel is now blocking food aid from going into Gaza. Israel has denied the accusations. Gaza is already the focus of multiple humanitarian aid organizations, and international leaders warn the humanitarian emergency will only get worse with shortages of food, water, medicine, and shelter. A report from an international authority on hunger says famine is imminent in northern Gaza and that an escalation of the war could push the territory's 2.3 million people into the brink of starvation. Meantime, back here in the U.S., Boeing CEO says that he is stepping down after what has already been an especially difficult year for the aircraft manufacturer. CEO David Calhoun says the decision was his and he will leave at the end of the year. Fallout has intensified following the January mid-air panel blowout aboard an Alaska Airlines 737 MAX. Since then, the FAA has put a limit on production of the aircraft. An audit of the Boeing factory near Seattle gave the company failing grades on close to three dozen aspects of production. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including battle over abortion. What to expect from tomorrow's Supreme Court argument over the abortion pill mifepristone. We speak with a senior counsel from the legal team spearheading the case. And Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales scouts the Senate for Republican and Democratic takes on abortion since the Dobbs decision. Welcome back. It is a high-stakes case and one of the most closely watched arguments of this term. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court makes its first significant return to the abortion issue since Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's the case that helped to overturn Roe versus Wade 2 years ago. The challenge from doctors and groups is in response to the easing of restrictions on the drug in recent years by the FDA. The groups represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom say without safety standards, the FDA is jeopardizing women's health. Women who want to end their pregnancies with the abortion pill no longer have to see a doctor in person to get a prescription, nor are they required to have a follow-up doctor's appointment to check for potentially life-threatening complications. Mifepristone was used in close to two-thirds of all abortions in the U.S. last year. And joining us now is Kelly Fedorik, senior counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, and Elizabeth Gillette, who suffered devastating consequences as a result of taking chemical abortion pills. Ladies, thank you to you both for being here. We appreciate it. Kelly, I want to start with you first. ADF is representing four medical associations, their members, and a handful of doctors in this case. For those who haven't really been following it, quickly tell us how we got here and, of course, why this case is so important.
Well, the FDA recklessly removed its original safeguards that provided women with in-person ongoing care when taking abortion drugs. And because they removed those, they put women's life in danger. And so we sue the FDA on behalf of doctors to hold them accountable. And we're asking the Supreme Court to reinstate those vital safeguards to protect the health and safety of women across this country.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I want to go to you now. I know when you were in your mid-20s, you had a chemical abortion and say the doctor never talked to you about the potential side effects and harm, but did give you an antibiotic in case you got an infection and told you that, quote, women feel a great sense of relief after taking the medication. Elizabeth, is that what happened to you?
Yeah, I was not properly prepared for the powerful drug that is the abortion pill. And I suffered devastating side effects. I found myself on the bathroom floor in a pool of blood until I ended up expelling the entire amniotic sac with my baby, a recognizable baby, inside. And the trauma from this horrific experience still follows me today in the form of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is nothing like what they told me would happen. It was minimized and the care was subpar.
And what would you want other women to know about these drugs?
This is not a safe and easy medication. This is not like a Tylenol. It is very powerful. The side effects, both physical, emotional, and spiritual, are devastating and can follow you for the rest of your life. This is not something that we need to take lightly. It's very serious.
Yeah, and Kelly, talk to us a little bit more about this case. What else do you want people to know about it? And ultimately, what are you hoping comes from it?
Well, we know these drugs are high risk. The FDA's own label says that roughly 1 in 25 women who take these drugs will end up in the emergency room. So regardless of what people's beliefs might be about abortion, we should all agree that women deserve the ongoing in-person care of a doctor when they're taking high-risk drugs. And that's exactly what we're asking the Supreme Court. We're going to show them tomorrow that these drugs have harmed women and that the FDA acted recklessly when it removed these essential safeguards. And the FDA needs to do its job and needs to put women's health first, because women deserve better and their health matters.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, any final thoughts before we let you both go?
Yeah, I just would like everybody to remember that this is an extremely powerful drug, and women deserve, we deserve to be treated with respect, and with the safeguards in place, we're worth it.
Yeah. Kelly and Elizabeth, thank you both for coming on today. We appreciate it. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Lawmakers on the Senate Judiciary Committee traded blows over so-called abortion rights during a hearing. Democrats and their witnesses sounded the alarm about what they say was a march to roll back women's bodily autonomy. Republicans say Democrats are on the wrong side of the issue. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has more.
Good evening, Tracy. This is the third Senate hearing on abortion policy since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe and sent the issue back to the states. Committee Chair Democrat Dick Durbin, a Catholic, called the state legislation on abortion chaotic and blamed Republicans for the lack of abortion access nationwide.
We must respect women's rights to make their own reproductive health decisions. But the question remains, will our Republican colleagues join us in this effort and support legal access to abortion and reproductive freedom?
That's coming from someone who voted on the Senate floor to compel a religious institution to use U.S. taxpayer dollars to perform an abortion on a minor without the knowledge or consent of her parents. That is an extreme position.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says he's looking to find some common ground.
What limitations do you have? I challenge every member of this committee on the Democratic side, pick a week in the birthing process where you would limit abortion. Just any week. I don't care if it's the last week. Just pick one. You won't, because you can't.
Republicans also claim polls show Americans want some sort of limitations on abortions.
The Republican position is not extreme. The position of many elected Democrats, however, is extreme. Every Democrat on this committee voted for the Women's Health Protection Act, which would allow abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy.
Georgia Democrat and committee member John Ossoff says his state passed a six-week abortion ban and tells me they now face a shortage of OBGYNs.
The risk of prosecution for obstetricians is deterring OB doctors from training in states with extreme bans.
Austin Denard, a practicing OBGYN living in Texas, testified about her own experience of traveling out of state to receive abortion care and the fear both she and her parents have due to abortion restrictions.
And under Texas's new laws, the penalties are so severe, 100 years in prison, huge fines, a loss of our medical license. It was humiliating.
Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will weigh in on yet another abortion issue. The justices will hear arguments in the lawsuit seeking to roll back the Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone, a drug used in medicated abortions. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, sacred silence reaction from Palm Sunday at the Vatican and what made this year different. Plus, light the fire, how a singer from the Emerald Isle is bringing the faith to the steps of Ireland's Parliament. Conflict in the Middle East, there was joy as thousands of Christians carried palms at Jerusalem's Mount of Olives. The route follows the same path Jesus rode when he went to Jerusalem for Passover. The joyous procession included music, songs, and dances along the route. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, told the faithful in attendance to not be afraid and that Jesus on the cross is the victory over the world. At the Palm Sunday Mass, Pope Francis reminded the faithful that Jesus entered Jerusalem as a humble king. During the Mass, Pope Francis chose not to read the homily that was prepared. EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief Andreas Tannhauser has more.
During Palm Sunday Mass in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis decided to let silence do the talking for his homily. As you remember, Tracy, in recent weeks, the Pope has been suffering of bronchitis, and because of that, he had delegated an aide to read his addresses for him. But yesterday, his prepared text was not read at all. This immediately prompted health concerns, but the Holy Father continued presiding at the service and reading his noon Angelus prayer. Traditionally, Pope Francis delivers a homily on Palm Sunday. The Vatican gave no immediate explanation for the decision, and instead of showing close-ups of the Pope, Vatican television also their coverage focused on the crowd. It's also interesting to understand how much the Holy Father's current health condition affected this choice, because Pope Francis will have a very long and busy week with seven celebrations to preside over in just 4 days. After the Mass, Pope Francis delivered his traditional and weekly Sunday Angelus. He condemned the concert hall shooting in Moscow. The Holy Father told the crowd in St. Peter's Square that he was praying for the victims of the vile terrorist attack, the worst that Russia has suffered in recent decades. May the Lord convert the hearts of those who plan, organize, and carry out these inhuman actions which offend God, the Pope said. At the end, Pope Francis invited Christians to enter Holy Week by entrusting our journey toward Easter to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Let us learn from her to draw near to Jesus in these days of Holy Week so that we may arrive at the joy of the resurrection, the Pope concluded. In Rome, Andreas Tannhauser, EWTN News Nightly.
On to Ireland now, where a very special concert in Northern Ireland this week will commemorate the Paschal fire lit by St. Patrick on the Hill of Slane in 433 AD. Dana, a world-famous Catholic artist who is also the first Irish winner of the Eurovision contest, will be singing her chart-topping hit, Light the Fire, at the Stormont Parliament buildings in Northern Ireland. Immediately following, a symbolic Paschal fire will be lit on the Parliament building steps. And Dana joins us now. So good to be with you. Always great to have you back on the show. You're welcome. So tell us a little bit more about the concert this week and what people can expect.
Well, the song Light the Fire was actually inspired by St. Patrick at the behest of my late brother-in-law, Father Kevin Scallon. He said, you know, he's a saint for today and his message is for the whole world. And I surprised myself at how little I knew about him, apart from shamrocks and snakes and green. But in fact, he was a victim of human trafficking. He was a slave. He had lost his faith and found it in his suffering. And he came back to a society that was pagan with human sacrifice. Mm. And the fire he lit converted Ireland, and then missionaries went out from Ireland. So this song has become more of a movement. My husband felt we needed to go to the Hill of Slane, where St. Patrick lit that fire, which we did last August, and almost 4,000 people joined us for rosary and Holy Mass and Eucharistic healing and song. And it was so joyful, and it's become a movement. And so the Bishop of the Church of Ireland, that would be the equivalent of the Episcopal Church or the Church of England, Bishop David MacLay, he loved that. And he also felt drawn to light the fire outside his cathedral. In the grounds of his cathedral is the burial place of St. Patrick, St. Bridget, and St. Columba. I couldn't be with him this St. Patrick's Day, but he wanted me to come to Stormont Parliament Buildings, which has just reconvened after many years now of not being able to proceed because of division. And we will have prayer. There's an ecumenical choir. I will sing Light the Fire. We will pray for the politicians who will make decisions about the future of Northern Ireland. And then afterwards, he will light on the steps of that parliament the fire, the paschal fire, as St. Patrick did. And really, it's a fire of faith and hope and love.
Dana, I love so much that you're doing this. This is so beautiful. We're almost out of time, unfortunately. But how many people are you expecting to be there? And if people can't attend, is there a way for them to watch?
This, I hope, will be streamed, and I will let you know if it is. But it's really for the politicians and leaders of both churches, people in politics, people in all walks of life that are leaders. And, you know, we just had two referenda rejected, the biggest no vote in the history of Ireland, where they wanted to change the definition of family and remove a reference to mother. And we need to light that fire that St. Patrick lit. We need it in our own hearts, and we need, and I will be actually having a mission of light the fire in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York next year, where so many people fled and found a home and brought their faith to that wonderful city. So please keep the mission of light the fire in your prayers.
We absolutely will. And Dana, please keep us posted on everything. We appreciate it. God bless you.
And you.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.